Welcome to Mysterious Topics, a podcast focusing on intriguing topics deserving further scrutiny. Each episode, the hosts examine a topic, add their opinions, and hopefully pique your interest as well. Visit MysteriousTopics.com for contact information and more. Now, here are your hosts, Chuck and John.
Greetings, John.
Hello, Chuck, and hello to our listeners. Today we'll be discussing the first attempt at colonization by England in North America, and it is known today as the Lost Colony of Roanoke Island.
And Roanoke Island is located in Dare County, North Carolina, just south of Kitty Hawk, of the Wright brothers' fame. Now, Queen Elizabeth I desired to establish a permanent English settlement in the New World. She wanted to exploit the riches of the New World and also to provide a base from which to send privateers on raids against the treasure fleets of Spain. And a privateer is basically a private person or a ship which is authorized by a government to attack foreign vessels during wartime. In today's age, we would probably refer to them as mercenaries. Now here, right away, we're talking about something negative, not just trying to establish the riches location in the New World, but also to do some raiding on the Spanish, which obviously at this time, back in the 1580s, England and Spain were very much at odds with each other. Now, a first attempt in the New World was made in 1583 when Sir Humphrey Gilbert tried to colonize St. John's, Newfoundland, but he drowned trying.
Yes, and Sir Gilbert's half-brother, who was Sir Walter Raleigh, subsequently got permission from the Queen on March 25th of 1584 and executed the details to colonize Roanoke Island. A more southern location made sense because of the much milder winters. The latitude of St. John's is 47.5 degrees north, and Roanoke Island's latitude is 35.9 degrees north. About 1 month later, Raleigh sent two men, Philip Amadas and Arthur Barlow, to explore the Roanoke Island area, and they were successful in establishing relations with the local natives. Based on this success, 1 year later, Raleigh organized a second expedition led by Sir Richard Grenville with five ships, three of which stayed in the Outer Banks. Tensions developed when the natives were blamed for stealing a silver cup and had their village sacked and burned. Not a good way to make friends.
Oh, definitely not a good way to make friends. Here you are in a new world, in a new area, and you're going to be confronting the natives of that area. And the last thing you want to do is create immediate enemies. And that's basically what happened when they sacked and burned a village over a silver cup. I don't care how valuable the silver cup was. That was not a very good thing to do. And I just want to go back to a little bit of what you just mentioned about the difference in the latitude. Actually, England is a very northerly latitude. Their climate is tempered by the ocean, but they are approximately 51.5 degrees north. And geographically speaking, that makes sense why they would try to colonize St. John's, Newfoundland first, because the distance between England and Newfoundland is much less than England to North Carolina. I think it's 2,400 miles to St. John's from England and 3,600 to North Carolina. So that's a pretty large difference. But obviously the climate difference in North Carolina was much more pleasant as far as winter time. And that makes sense as to why they would end up in North Carolina rather than St. John's, Newfoundland. Now, despite this incident that you mentioned, John, where that they had this silver cup incident and the pillaging of the village, Grenville, he decided to leave 108 men to establish a colony at the north end of Roanoke Island, and he promised to return the next April of 1586 with more men and fresh supplies. Now, this colony was run by Ralph Lane. These colonists were ill-prepared and not particularly clever because, although they depended upon the local natives for food, they also antagonized the natives by such tactics as kidnapping them and holding them hostage in exchange for information. Again, we're talking about creating a dangerous situation by doing these things. April of 1586 came to pass with no sign of the relief fleet, and the bad blood from the raiding incident spurred an attack on the fort. However, the colonists were able to repel the attack. Now, the colonists, in desperate need of supplies and no sign of Grenville's relief fleet, accepted a return trip to England when Sir Francis Drake put in at Roanoke after destroying the Spanish colony of St. Augustine. The entire colony returned with Drake to England. Shortly after they left, wouldn't you know it, the relief fleet arrived, and they found the colony abandoned. And they also returned to England, but they left a small detachment behind to maintain an English presence and protect Raleigh's claim to the island.
The next year, 1587, Raleigh sent 115 colonists led by John White, who was named governor, to establish a colony on Chesapeake Bay. But first, they were told to stop at Roanoke to pick up Grenville's men. But when they arrived in July, they found nothing except a skeleton that may have been from one of the men left to guard the island. These 115 colonists were ordered to stay at Roanoke to establish the colony. Trouble again brewed with the tribes they had battled with earlier since the Silver Cup incident, and the colonists convinced Governor White to return to England to explain the desperate situation. He did return to England, but left 115 colonists, which included the remaining men, women, and children from the Atlantic crossing, including Virginia Dare, who was the first English-born child in the Americas, and Governor White's granddaughter. White barely made it back because of the difficult winter conditions, and he also did not want to return to Roanoke in the winter, and the return trip was delayed until spring, and then only with two small ships because the coming of the Spanish Armada required all larger ships to remain to fight. These small vessels never made it because the captains were greedy and attempted to capture several Spanish ships. They were captured themselves and their cargo seized, so they simply turned around because they had no supplies left to deliver.
Now, John, when Governor White left these 115 colonists, which included men, women, and children, can you imagine yourself being among that group of 115 colonists and being a pioneer in this new country where there is a lot of dangers perhaps lurking around the corner?
Yeah, it would be, and I'm not sure if they were aware of all the dangers, but like we said before, the previous expeditions there didn't seem attempting to try to make friends, although they did make friends with some of the tribes, but they were obviously antagonizing others. And then you also had the impending war with Spain and the Spanish ships looking for this area because they knew what the Queen was up to, and they wanted to destroy that outpost for, you know, from raids. So it was a very tenuous situation for them.
I'm trying to imagine myself doing that. I'm trying to think what the conditions might have been in England at the time, and maybe I would have wanted to get out of England and try something new. But at the same time, I'm thinking today, it's almost like going to out in outer space to Mars or something and being one of the first people colonizing Mars. that might be a little bit extreme as a comparison, but I don't think I would have wanted to be one of the 115 individuals involved. The war with Spain now prevented a return to Roanoke for 3 more years. When White landed on August 18th of 1590, Virginia Dare's third birthday, no trace was found of the 90 men, 17 women, and 11 children, and also no sign of struggle or battle, and the settlement was deserted. The only clues were the word Croatoan carved into a post and C-R-O, crow, carved into a tree.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm sure that the person in charge told someone to go carve Croatoan into the fence post to let them know where we're intending to go. And he gave instructions to a bunch of other people as they're getting ready to leave. And then he happens to go out and see this person carving something into a nearby tree, but not into the fence post. And he probably said, "What are you doing?" And the guy said, "Well, I'm doing what you told me." I said, "No, I told you to put it on the fence post, not over on a tree in the area." And so that's why he only got CRO in that tree, and then he went over to where the guy told him in the first place to put it.
That's a good theory, John. It could be the right one. Yeah, and all the houses and fortifications were dismantled, which meant the departure had not been hurried. They had time to, or somebody had time to dismantle them, whether the colonists did or perhaps the natives did later. I still am puzzled why they were dismantled. And what do you think, John? Why do you think they were dismantled?
I don't know why they would do it themselves. That just seems like extra work if you're leaving anyway. That's why I'm guessing that maybe after they left, one of the local native tribes who they had tensions with could have come there and noticed they left and thought, why don't we just dismantle this thing so if they do come back, they won't be able to stay here, or they'll have to redo it or something and make it difficult on them.
That's plausible. Well, White had instructed the colonists to also carve a Maltese cross on a nearby tree to indicate their departure was forced, but no Maltese cross was found. Now, White took this to mean they moved to Croatoan Island, which is now Cape Hatteras National Seashore. But a storm prevented a search for the colonists, so they left the next day. Now, they left the next day. They didn't just leave to go searching for people on Roanoke Island. They left to go back to England. And this doesn't make sense to me. A storm obviously was probably over the next day if they left. So why not go and look for the colonists rather than go back to England, which takes about 2.5 months.
Yeah, I don't understand that at all. And I don't necessarily understand I can understand them having a clue to carve a Maltese cross on a nearby tree to indicate their departure was forced. But if their departure was forced, would they be allowed to carve a Maltese cross on a nearby tree?
They wouldn't have enough time. They'd have to...
Yeah, I just don't know if that is necessarily a good idea. They should maybe had some other way that they could quickly do something to make them know that they were forced.
Well, Thomas Harriot, he was one of the 7 men in Roanoke in 1585 and 1586. And he wrote reports about the state of affairs on Roanoke Island. But he mentioned nothing of the bloody battles and hardships. In fact, his reports were more positive. Now, this might have indicated he was trying to present propaganda to encourage future settlers to join the colony, since he didn't talk about anything negative, only positive things.
Yeah, it's very possible that that's what that was about. Because as we have seen, that there were plenty of negative things to talk about.
Right.
12 years later, in 1602, Raleigh bought his own ship and guaranteed the sailors' wages so they would not be distracted by privateering, and attempted a return to Roanoke, but made it only to the Outer Banks, and then bad weather forced them to return to England. Raleigh was arrested for treason and thus unable to send any further missions. Now here again, bad weather forced them to return to England. I think we both have questions about that. Why would bad weather make you return all the way to England?
Yeah, it's the same thing that we just mentioned, only in another incident. And go looking for the colonists. Go check things out. Which they were very close to the area. So to go back and spend 2.5 months traveling back to England, it doesn't make sense. There has to be some ulterior motive for them doing that.
Right, and just to explain why Raleigh was arrested for treason, he had gone on a couple voyages to the South American area in search of the legendary city of El Dorado, where there was supposed to be a lot of gold and that. And on his later trip, he was a little older and stayed behind on, I believe, the island of Trinidad when his group, led by his son, also by the name of Walter, went in and they found a Spanish village, and they decided to raid it. And when they eventually made it back to England, the King of Spain at that time sent him a letter protesting it, and that was King James now. Queen Elizabeth had died. Queen Elizabeth was an ally of Raleigh, but King James didn't like Sir Walter Raleigh very much, and he didn't need much of a reason to put him on trial for treason. And as a result, he was convicted and he was beheaded.
Right. Sir Walter Raleigh was kind of good friends with the Queen, and when she died, then King James kind of took over, and like you said, John, he expedited the trial, and which led to Sir Walter Raleigh's execution. And for him to be beheaded, it's I guess they did that a lot back then, but it to me it sounds very gruesome. And even more gruesome, after his head was chopped off, they put it in a pouch and gave it to his wife. And I mean, who wants to have somebody's head in a velvet bag or something? But anyway, after she died, they returned his head to his tomb at St. Margaret's Church. And actually, you can go and visit his tomb today if you want to. I don't know if I want to or not, but apparently it's still there today. And his execution was not very popular with the citizens in that day, because they felt that Sir Walter Raleigh was not that bad of a person. And the execution and the trial that preceded the execution was pretty much unfair.
So just one more point to bring up. Back in 1950, the Spanish thought this colony was successful and they wanted to destroy it so it could not be used as a base for privateering. So then, like I said, in 1590, they did find the remnants of the colony by accident, but assumed it was only an outlying base. But then they, the Spanish, had to return home because of the Anglo-Spanish War. So as far as now, as we go into the theories, that's just an important point to bring up. Now, one of the first theories as to what happened to this lost colony was that they integrated with local tribes. Reported sightings of European captives at various Native American settlements have been noticed. In 1612, four Englishmen, two boys and one girl, were sighted at the Eno settlement of Rittenauk. Speculation has it that the girl was Virginia Dare, who would have been about 25 at the time. Hatteras Indians tell us several of their ancestors were white people that had gray eyes. And of course, Native Americans usually have brown eyes. Also, another theory is that records from French Huguenots claim to have met Tuscaroras with blonde hair and blue eyes. The Tuscarora were another Native American tribe in the area. And another theory is that settlers may have been wiped out by local tribes because of bad blood and feeling that their land was being taken over.
Another theory is the possibility that the settlers tried to return to England and they perished at sea in the small ships that Governor White left behind. Those ships that the governor left behind were really not meant to sail across the ocean. They were meant just to travel around the local area in the Roanoke Island area. And for them to attempt to take those little ships back to England was a big risk.
Although they did get there that same way.
Yeah, that's true. Another thing is perhaps the Spanish destroyed the colony. Now, this theory is probably unlikely because the Spanish, as John mentioned, as you just mentioned a few minutes ago, they were still looking for the colony 10 years later in 1600. Now, climate might have been a factor since tree ring cores showed that 1587 to 1589 were very dry years and also the worst growing seasons in many years. Now, this would have affected both the colonists and the natives, making them both prone to pillage the other in order to survive. Disease caused by New World microbes that their bodies had never encountered before. Now, I think often of people going, traveling into foreign countries and being told, for example, to Mexico and being told to be careful and not drink the water because if you haven't been there before or not been there very often, your intestinal system probably wouldn't be able to handle the microbes that would be in the water. Whereas the natives of the area, their systems were already accustomed to them and they would have no problem. Now, this can go both ways. Like the new colonists could have also introduced microbes to the natives, and vice versa, the natives could have given microbes back to the new colonists. So it could have been a problem.
It's interesting that you use Mexico as an example, because I believe that happened to the Aztecs when the Spanish conquistadors, and it would have been maybe just 100 years before this or somewhere between 1400 and 1600 when the conquistadors went to Mexico, first as friends and later as enemies. But one of the things that wiped out a great deal of the Aztecs were the diseases that the Spanish soldiers brought with them, such as, I believe it was either measles or smallpox or one of those that the Aztecs were never exposed to before.
And something like measles or especially smallpox is a very serious condition. Maybe just having some gastrointestinal problem is a nuisance and very uncomfortable. But if you contract smallpox, like you said, John, it can wipe you out or wipe out many people. So it could very well be a problem. Now, shoreline erosion is probably the reason for little archaeological evidence that is found over the years, including today. You get the wind and the wave action on the sandy soil. It doesn't take much to totally change the terrain, and little evidence would be available.
Yes, yeah, so there is shore erosion naturally going on there a lot, especially if they get a tropical storm or a hurricane, that can have a quick effect on the shoreline erosion.
Well, John, I know you were at that Roanoke Island area a few years ago. Can you tell us anything about your visit there?
Yes, we did visit there. It was probably in the late 90s, and they have it's called Roanoke Island Festival Park, and it's an interactive family attraction that celebrates the first English settlement in America. The centerpiece of the 25-acre island park adjacent to Manteo is Elizabeth II, a representation of one of the seven English ships from the Roanoke Voyage of 1585. Now, you can actually go walk on this ship. The ship is in the water in the little bay there, and you can walk on it and see it, actually stand on it, and it's really great to see this. It's a representation, so they've built it. It's not an original boat, of course, but they built it to be just like the ship that they would have had. And you can see it's not a real big boat. Probably, I'm going to guess, between 60 and 75 feet long. It's a three-mast wooden ship, and it seems very sturdily built, but yet rather small to try to voyage across the ocean. And in this festival park, you can walk the grounds, and there are buildings that they have. They would have had their little houses built out of logs, and they actually have people in character standing at different locations. And we happened to go to one standing in front of this little house, and there was a man in character, and he would tell us about what life was like then, and we were able to ask him questions, and I asked him quite a few questions, and the couple that I can remember was one. They have beds. They made beds out of logs, and then they took some rope and ran it across the logs to act sort of as bed slats. And then I believe they brought some material along for their own bed ticking, and then they would stuff it with hay. Now, of course, in hay, there are many bugs and that can get in there. So they'd sew them shut to protect them from the bugs. And when they would go to bed at night, they would take that rope, and they'd make sure it was nice and tight so that they wouldn't sag, and they'd have a comfortable night's rest. And the gentleman in character told us that's where people would say when they were going tonight. They would say, good night, sleep tight, and don't let the bed bugs bite.
Yeah, I'm sure the bed bugs probably were a problem back then.
Yeah, sure they were.
They still can be today. In fact, they still are today many times.
Yeah, they're making a comeback, I guess.
Now, as far as that bed was concerned, I know when I've gone to museums or similar reenactments that you're mentioning here, the beds always seemed extremely small. Was that the situation there with what you had seen there?
Yeah, it wasn't even the size of a twin bed. It was small. It was closer to a cot size. But, you know, in thinking about that, if we went to a new place and had to build something from logs, you probably wouldn't make it huge because you have a limited amount of supplies. You have a limited amount of rope to run between it. So you're going to make it just big enough, I would imagine.
Yeah. And now this representation, this boat or ship that you were on or were able to look at, it was built to scale, I'm assuming. So it gives you a really good perspective of what kind of a size situation these travelers were dealing with back then.
Yes. Yes. It is a actual representation of the ship that they would have had.
You would have got pretty cramped on that ship, I would think, correct?
Well, depending how many people, it wouldn't be for a 2.5 month trip. I guess things would have been pretty tight. And this gentleman that was talking in character, I noticed his clothing, and I asked him about it because he was wearing full clothing, I think even a little vest in that, and he did explain that their clothing was all made out of wool. So in this North Carolina heat, apparently the wool, when you sweat, gets wet, of course, but that actually keeps your skin cool because of the moisture in the wool. But I just couldn't help thinking, yeah, you don't see a lot of people walking around in North Carolina today wearing wool head to toe. So,
no, I can't imagine that. But I know you're correct in what you're saying. But I wouldn't want to be wearing wool clothing in North Carolina on a 95 degree and humid conditions in North Carolina. That's for sure.
No, but if anybody is going to be vacationing in North Carolina, I would highly recommend visiting the Roanoke Island Festival Park if you're at all interested in this sort of thing and history and that. It's well worth it, and it's a nice little quaint town and area there too.
It sounds like it is, right?
Right, very near Kitty Hawk. So you could also visit the Wright brothers' location where they flew their first plane.
Hey, you could be a travel agent, John. There's yeah. some recommendations here. Here's where you go.
Yeah, and then you just travel down the way, and you'll get to Cape Hatteras. And from Cape Hatteras, it kind of curves in there. And then, well, there's another island called Ocracoke off the coast of the Cape Hatteras Island. You'd have to take a ferry, but on Ocracoke Island, that's of Edward Teach fame, who was Blackbeard.
Ah, great. I remember talking about that with the Oak Island podcast.
Yes. In a story on NationalGeographic.com published on December 6, 2013, titled "Have We Found the Lost Colony of Roanoke Island?" The story is by Tanya Basu. They explain how they're using modern technology to try to locate some of the areas where this lost colony might have been. Malcolm LeCompte, a research associate at the Elizabeth City State University in North Carolina, was responsible for the addition of GPR, which is ground penetrating radar, in the archaeological search for what happened to the lost colonists of Roanoke. The process began earlier this year, which would have been 2013, with a satellite survey of the site. What we do is we get the oldest maps we can find so we can get a historic sense of what was there and what's there now and orient them, LeCompte said. The point is to compare what may have been there in the past to what is there now. Researchers look for similarities between the old maps and the current geography of the area. Once they identify where the spots on the map correspond with today's landscape, a painstaking process of laying out a grid and systematically searching it with their GPR ensues. Technology admits radio waves into the ground and measures the echo as the signal bounces off of various things buried underground. Essentially, it measures the depth that signals travel before hitting something that causes a measurable bounce back. In other words, signals potentially indicate a hidden object underground. Metal objects, like the iron cannons that have been found at the site, act like giant antennas. Graves and coffins are also detectable because they contain voids with different densities and poorer conductive properties than the surrounding soil. LeCompte and his colleagues found a previously undetected pattern that may indicate the presence of one or more structures, possibly made of wood, under 3 feet of soil. I don't know if it's one or a group of structures, he said, adding that they could be joined or they could be close together. Perhaps the wood of the structures collapsed over time, leaving impressions in the surrounding soil. The Museum of the Albemarle Swindell suggested the use of a proton magnetometer to enable the researchers to double-check their GPR findings. Much more sensitive than a metal detector, the device can spot objects buried about 13 feet underground. The device measures distortions of the Earth's magnetic field due to the presence of various objects buried underground. We're looking for anything that affects the local magnetic field, Swindell stressed. That could be things like burn pits. Swindell, for his part, thinks there may also be remains of a palisades that would have been used by farmers to keep wild animals away from crops. The presence of the buried structure and the fence strongly indicate that there was some sort of colonial presence in the area. What complicates the story further is the presence of later colonial sites in the area through the 1700s. Unfortunately, neither piece of technology has shed light on the role of Native American populations in the area. That's a puzzle that remains to be solved.
Now, I'm thinking if some of these things that they located were only 3 feet underground, they would start doing some kind of archaeological digging in that area, because that isn't very far, and actually physically look for something that might be that close to the surface.
Yes, and I believe they plan on doing that. But they were, as this man goes on to talk about, in the days of the Roanoke colony, relations with the local Native Americans were mixed. Roanoke was geographically located in the crux of a socio-political friction between the Sikoton, who held sway over Roanoke, and the Chowanoke, who controlled the nearby waterways. Tensions were especially high between the colonists and the Sikoton tribe. There is no doubt that there was a lot of hostility. Not all the tribes were hostile, but some of them were hostile. They felt imposed upon. There was fighting between the groups, both among the tribes and between some of the native peoples and the English settlers. It would not surprise me that the Sikoton would want to be done and get rid of the English. Whether groups of Sikoton banded together to rid themselves of what they saw as interlopers is anyone's guess. The area does seem to hold clues to contact between local tribes and European colonists in the 16th and 17th centuries. The next step, as you just proposed, in solving the age-old American mystery, is that they have to start digging some holes.
And I'm sure they will do it very carefully. One crumb of dirt at a time, and just see what's there.
And it could also be in a swamp area, too, which really complicates things.
Definitely.
What do you think happened to the Lost Colony, Chuck?
I believe there are a few likely possibilities. One is the colonists just got really frustrated and tried to go back to England with the small ships, and then they perished at sea. They probably knew the chances of getting back safely were not very good, but they also felt their situation in the New World was not very pleasant, and they never had any idea when the help would come, when the reinforcements would come with new supplies to help their situation. Beyond that, I think there was probably some killing by the local native tribes, as you just mentioned. At least one of the tribes was very hostile, and so that even lends more support to the theory that some of the colonists were wiped out. In my mind, the most likely theory is those first two things I mentioned are probably part of it, but I think the majority of the colonists were integrated into the local tribes, probably into one of the more friendly tribes and not the truly hostile tribes. So if I had to pick one of the theories, I would think the integration into the local tribes would be it. What do you think, John?
Well, I think it may very well have been a combination of several of the theories that we previously discussed. Number one, they said from 1587 to 1589, which would have been right when they were there, the evidence suggests that there was a pretty big drought in the area, which would have cut down on provisions for both the Native Americans and the colony, making the situation even more desperate. That, along with these people waiting for 3 years with no sight of the ships coming back with supplies, would make them feel desperate. So I think it's very possible that a group within the Lost Colony, some of them probably felt that they should take those two little ships and try to go back. Other people probably felt, well, we have to stay here because that's our duty. And also, they probably all wouldn't be able to fit on those two ships. So I think probably eventually, maybe even there was some infighting between the colonists, and eventually some of them took those ships and tried to return to England and probably didn't make it all the way. And that's why we have no sign of them. And then the rest of them at that point whether they tried to stay there a while longer or not, probably eventually knew that that they just couldn't work this anymore, and they would have to integrate themselves in with some of the other tribes. So they had as their plan, if a disaster happened, they were to break up into small groups and to go to these some of these other friendly tribes to be integrated in, because they wouldn't be able to handle them all in one tribe. So I believe it could very well be a little bit of several of those theories.
And I also think back to what we just mentioned a little while ago about the blonde hair and blue eyes being included in some of the members of the descendants of those tribes, which adds a little bit more support to the theory that some of them might have been integrated into the tribes.
Yes, I agree.
Now, the lessons that were learned on Roanoke Island may have helped the next group of English settlers who founded their own colony only 17 years later at Jamestown, Virginia, which is probably only about 200 miles north of Roanoke Island, approximately. It's now called Colonial National Historical Park, which became the first permanent English settlement in the Americas on May 14th of 1607. Now, John, this would be another site to include in the tourist suggestions, Colonial National Historical Park, as long as anybody's down in that area.
Yeah, I believe that is also there in character there.
Yes.
I believe it's even larger scale, because that was that colony, like you said, the lessons learned, one of them had to have been, why don't we make sure we support these people and send them regular supplies until they get established?
Something so very obvious, but for several reasons, like we mentioned, they didn't get the support they truly needed.
Okay, so I think that about covers it, Chuck, right?
Right. I want to thank all our listeners for listening to our podcast and to direct them to mysteriestopics.com.